Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or simply hoping to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, the other day we had the opportunity to interview Joshua Shea from Maine.
From Maine, Central Maine.
Central Maine, from our same time zone.
Right,
we haven't done an interview in a long time, but and we had worked on scheduling this interview for a while.
For a long time.
Right.
Weeks.
Between our different schedules and stuff, it was difficult to schedule. But
interesting interview, though.
Yes.
Title of his book is...
It is The Addiction Nobody Talks About.
Nobody Talks About. And...
Yeah. So we were... It was all about pornography addiction and alcohol addiction.
That's right. He tells his story, essentially. Yeah. But not in a purient way or not in a... He really traces his business successes and talks about... He was successful in all these ventures, but he was doing it at the price, at the cost of his family.
Right.
Gave up his family. And then he gradually drifted into addictions. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't, what's interesting about his story is it wasn't a single addiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There were several areas where he went off the rails.
Yeah.
And he wanted to tell that story, that it wasn't just alcohol.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've interviewed people who work who've struggled with addiction and now work in the addictions field, you know, trying to help other people and everything. So it was really interesting to talk with someone who experienced addictions, but isn't necessarily now working as an addiction counselor or anything like that. He's working to raise awareness, especially as it relates to pornography addiction, because that's as the book entitled, it's an addiction that not many people talk about.
And we don't know much about, we don't really know very much about it.
Right.
There hasn't been a lot of research because it's a topic that many people avoid.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing about, that was interesting about Josh, and I guess we're almost on a first name basis with him now, is that he was a magazine publisher and a writer himself. And so he's able to write and explain in very graphic ways his rise and fall, and that's what was interesting about this is that he was able to articulate very clearly, and really understands. He's been sober, I think, for 4 years, and so he's had time to get some perspective, but also to articulate his rise and fall very well, very easy to understand, very readable. It's a fascinating story as you watch his rise and then his fall, because he entered a tough market, that magazine publishing.
Right.
When most magazines are going out of business, he develops a successful regional magazine.
Right.
You know, that in itself was impressive, but it came at a cost.
Yeah. He started and successfully launched and continued a magazine. He started a film festival out there, and he even served on city council.
Right,
he was elected to city council, and all the while, you know, struggling with this addiction or these addictions. Mm-hmm. And then, he kind of...
It was always behind the scene. You know, when he tells the story, he talks about his rise in business, but he keeps this story going about his increasing addiction. So as his business and publishing fortunes rise, at the same time, his addictions are increasing. Right. And you realize very early that there's a race between these two things, and you know that something calamitous is going to happen eventually. You just don't know when.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating story.
It is. So take a listen. Let us know what you think. We'd love to, you know, give feedback. The link to his website is in the show notes. It's recoveringpornaddict.com.
Right.
And you can get information about the book and other...
Right.
He blogs and offers lots of other information.
And the other thing I like about this that he brings out, not he doesn't bring it out explicitly, but in many ways, addiction is addiction. Mm-hmm. It almost doesn't matter what right. you're addicted to. Yeah. Addiction is addiction. It comes from the same brain regions and the same brain chemicals. So be careful.
Yeah. You know,
that I think that's the warning here is be careful.
Absolutely. So, all right. Well, here's the interview. Enjoy. Well, I'm glad that we finally get a chance to talk. I know we've been emailing back and forth about it for a little while now, and so I appreciate your patience and so glad to get a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, I am too. This has been an interesting process promoting my book and learning how to these types of things work, and I appreciate you hanging with me and still having me on.
No problem.
Glad to do it. It's good to talk to you finally after reading the book and waiting all these weeks, so good to finally make that.
And it's nice to talk to somebody who's actually read the book.
Well, more should.
Well, a lot of these shows I'm learning, nobody is at all prepared.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for the most part.
Oh, good grief. Well,
we're prepared, so.
Absolutely. We have some specific questions, and because there's, we've talked to a lot of people who work with people or have struggled with various forms of substance abuse. And so this is a great, it'll be great to talk about a different form of addiction and to, talk about it just from a different perspective.
Right.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but let's start out. Tell us a little bit about yourself and, what you do, a little bit about your background and everything before we kind of get into the book a little bit.
Well, I am originally from Central Maine. I still live here. I got into journalism when I was very young, actually as a high school student. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fell in love with it and started to work my way up and eventually ended up having my own magazine in Central Maine. It was a lifestyle magazine, like those glossy ones you have looking at dining and entertainment and the arts scene, wherever you are. And because I was able to start that after about 15 years in journalism, I was also able to launch one of Maine's largest film festivals, which was a wonderful experience. And as people began to know me and liked what I was writing about, what I was saying, they urged me to run for local office. So I became a city councilor. So I was a very, very busy man there, 6, 7, 8 years ago. But what people never really realized was that I was hiding both a pornography addiction and an alcohol addiction. And was doing a darn good job hiding it for many, many years. But when my businesses started to go south, when things got rough, and I'm not very good when my back is against the wall, because it hasn't been that many times in life, I made the absolutely ridiculous decision to pull myself off of my bipolar medication, believing that I could tap into my manic side, and that would be more energy, more time to try to rescue the businesses. It's, you guys both know this is something that a lot of people with bipolar struggle with from time to time is, wanting to pull themselves off their meds. And it was an absolute nightmare because I started to use alcohol and started to use pornography in quantities and in durations that I never had before, eventually leading me to talking with women in online chat rooms. And after, 2 or 3 months of that, unfortunately, one of them ended up being a minor. It was a 14-year-old girl. I learned of this when the Maine State Police showed up at my door one morning in March of 2014. But as horrible as that all was, that was the thing that saved my life. That was the intervention that nobody else could have given me. That was the wake-up call that I needed my entire life. And I'm now just past 4 years, literally yesterday, for alcohol, and about two weeks ago for pornography, sober. And I've had just a fantastic recovery. I feel better mentally, emotionally, physically than I ever have before. And having written this book and now getting out there and talking about it and talking about the issues of porn addiction, that's what I really feel like I'm here for now. I kind of feel like all that other stuff is in the past, and this is sort of my purpose now.
Did I understand you correctly? You said you're 4 years sober from alcohol?
4 years sober alcohol yesterday, and 4 years and about 10 days from pornography.
Oh, I thought you said 2 weeks from pornography.
Oh, no. That'd be a real letdown.
Yeah, you we had to do this in person then. Okay, so pardon me for slipping. Yeah, the scene when the police show up at your house is just gut-wrenching in the book, particularly with your son there. That was a heart-wrenching thing to read through.
It's tough. I've probably read it 500 times. I've probably edited it again and again. And it's one of those things that, you know, and I've told it on a lot of these shows, and it's one of those times where with a lot of this, there's so much shame and there's so much embarrassment. But because of my place in the community, 2 hours later, when my wife had bailed me out of jail, we came home to TV news cameras in my front yard. Right. And I was the top story in the newspaper for several days. So somewhere along this way during my recovery, I just realized that, you know, my dirty laundry is out there. Just go ahead and Google my name and you'll learn every sordid detail you want. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, I might as well see what I can do to make this for good. Right. And I understand why a lot of people run and hide. I get it. But I was already out there with this, so I might as well see what I can do to make some good out of it.
Well, that sort of anticipated one of our first questions, because you talk about why you wrote the book in that section, A Note from the Author. And I was going to ask you to summarize for our listeners why you wrote the book, but you sort of did that in that last explanation. You were already out there because you were a real celebrity.
It's a little egotistical to say it, but yeah, I really was. And it's, mm-hmm. I was starting to gain a lot of recognition actually in Northern New England for the things I was doing. And I seemed like I was on an upward trajectory, and there were certainly narcissistic tendencies with the life I was living. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at the end of the night, when all of the dinners were done and all the networking events were over and I was there by myself at my house, that was just when I was at my loneliest and at the worst, because it was just me there and I needed, you know, the chemicals of alcohol and the stimulation of pornography to just get me through those you know, alone times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Well, you know, and the book starts out with, you know, a story from what you were talking about a few minutes ago with the chat rooms, and it really pulls the reader in, because it, you know, you can, you know, if you're, as you're reading it, you can feel the anticipation that you must have been experiencing at the time, that sometimes, you know, really fuels addiction and fuels that what we'll talk about later with the dopamine that you talk about, you know, really kind of drives some of those behaviors.
Oh, absolutely. And when I put that part of the book, that is, you know, to me, the most graphic part of the book. Mm-hmm. I really worked hard in finding a publisher who didn't want to make this tawdry. This is not a how-to book. You know, this is not a, here's a sordid tale of penthouse letters and whatnot. I didn't want to go down that road, but I knew that I needed to illustrate what I was doing on a typical night. And that is, you know, my behavior on a typical night. And I really wanted to show that my porn addiction got to such a critical place that it really wasn't even about self-pleasure anymore. It was about controlling somebody else, because I had no control in my daily life. And that was how I maintained my illusion of control, was by convincing somebody through, you know, lies and deceit and manipulation to do something on the other end of my computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you kind of point out, you have this great line in the book where you say something to the effect of, I'm paraphrasing, but something to the effect of, you know, describing an addiction to someone who doesn't struggle with an addiction is the same as describing parenting to someone who doesn't have kids. Talk a little bit about what this process was to you, what addiction is to you, because I really like how you explained that in the book.
Well, I just think it's one of these things where you look at something like a school shooting or a mass murder, some just horrible event, and I always hear people say, oh my goodness, how could somebody do that? How can somebody just, and it's like, well, they're not okay. They're not healthy. And if you've never experienced this, it's one of those things that you can't explain to somebody else. I know that, you know, 99.5% of my life, I would never have allowed myself to go down these roads. But little bit by little bit, the chemicals inside me changed. I was not taking care of myself whatsoever. And I allowed myself bit by bit to get to a point where my understanding of cause and effect got cloudy, my understanding of consequences got cloudy, and it's like oxygen. It's like needing to eat. You know, hold your breath. Just keep holding your breath. And the average person would say, well, you have to breathe again. Well, that's the way addiction feels. If you don't go and gulp that giant, you know, oxygen, you're not going to survive. And despite the fact that, you know, after I'd put down the Red Bull and tequila for the night and say, I'm not doing this tomorrow, or after I'd finish, you know, with another chat room excursion, well, I'd feel horrible. I'm not doing this again tomorrow. There I am, you know, 20 hours later, ready to restart this whole thing up again and go through the process again, because I had no other skills when it came to coping.
Is that on page 52 and 53, where you start to explain addiction, you use the phrase, it's a disease of the mind. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that the first time I looked at pornography, and you read this in the book, the first time I looked at pornography, it felt the same way that the first time I got drunk at a wedding when I was in the, you know, mm-hmm. Pornography was 11, 12 years old. You know, getting drunk was 14 or 15. It was just this revelation. It was like the hallelujah chorus was playing in the background that, you know, holy crap, I've just found something that is going to be my guide through life. This is going to be my fallback. This is what I need to get through the day. And at those ages, not really understanding that there were problems with that thinking, just knowing that I couldn't share this behavior with my family or my friends. And I had this secret little side of me that, you know, this was how I coped with stuff. I got through the day. I survived, whether it was being, you know, in a very abusive situation with a babysitter when I was 4 or 5 years old, or just getting through the stress of regular high school life or into, you know, jobs in my 20s and whatnot. This was always my backup. You know, here I am. If I'm in public, well, I can drink. If I'm by myself, I can utilize pornography. These two things are going to make me feel better.
So those, I see a bunch of folks in their 20s who use marijuana that way. They know at the end of the day they can go home. No matter how bad the day is, they know at the end of the day they have that their little friend there at home, and everything is okay. Everything becomes okay. So that's what pornography meant to you.
Yeah, but unfortunately, when things got really bad, you know, yeah, at the end of the day, I could have some Red Bull and tequila, and maybe I'd look at porn. You know, this is through for most of my life. But when things got really bad there at the end, the normal day, it wasn't, you know, the average person who goes home and, you know, takes a couple hits off their bong. Well, there aren't enough bong hits that you can take when you reach a certain place in your life. So, well, I've got to put the marijuana down and I've got to move on to something else. Right. And that's kind of the way that it was for me, where I was able to maintain with how I drank and how I utilized pornography for 20 years. But when everything really came down at one time, I was lost, and they both became very critical.
And that's when going off your medication made such a crucial difference, right? Because that was
absolutely, absolutely.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was such a mistake. And I don't know that we wouldn't be talking about the same ending to my story just a little further down the road. Right. I think that the medication absolutely speeded up my descent, but with the alienation from my family, with the slow increasing use of alcohol, with my companies slowly falling apart, getting off my meds just made everything go a lot faster. It was this was a runaway train, and if the police hadn't shown up at the door, something was going to get me anyway. I should have driven my car into a house, right, for how many times that I drove drunk stupidly. It just it happened to be that the pornography was the thing that finally took me down.
Right.
But something was going to, and I think I say this in the book, I only give even odds that I'd be here talking to you today if the police hadn't shown up.
Yeah, there's a number of ways this could have ended badly for you. But I wondered about that. That was one of the questions I had, that had you not gone off your medication, this was inevitable anyway.
Probably.
It's just that the medication hastened it. It hastened the demise, because everything was crumbling. Everything was falling apart. Right.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think when we try to talk and teach about some of these difficulties, it's always interesting to talk about. It almost ends up being a chicken or the egg thing. You know, you were talking about your bipolar medications. You were talking about when you were first exposed to pornography and first exposed to alcohol. As you look back, do you see a timeline as it relates to, you know, some of the issues related to bipolar disorder when they first started to emerge, as compared to, you know, using pornography to meet one need, or alcohol to meet a different need?
In looking back, I guess this is like a stew, and there are a lot of ingredients, and I'm not sure precisely how each played I know what played roles. I don't really assign percentages. I don't, you know, if I came home and I was absolutely exhausted at night, well, it was just easier to drink. If I came home and I was wired and I'd been involved with an activity where I was with a lot of people, well, I wanted to jump on the computer and go down the pornography route. It was really something where it depended on the moment, but I had, you know, in a sick cross-addicted way, I thought I'm better than most people because I have these two things that can get me through the day. But you know, towards the end, as you read in the book, I'm going downstairs to the pub that's downstairs from my office, having liquid lunches, and then making sure happy hour starts earlier and earlier every day. Mm-hmm. And when my wife wouldn't bring home, you know, my daily Red Bull, she thought I was just drinking that to stay up and work on my magazine. But I'm actually mixing that with tequila and trying to get through the night. I'd get angry at her. So there are so many pieces that played into my downfall, from, you know, things in childhood to things happening then to DNA. It's one of these things where a lot of people have said to me, this is a perfect storm. This was just a perfect storm. It all came together at some time. And had it not been then, it probably would have been further down the road. I think that I didn't have the coping mechanisms. I didn't have the survival skills that I should have developed when I was younger, and something was going to come and bite me in the butt one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Josh, one of the things that hits close to home here with Bernie and I, we tend to work long hours, and this sort of sent the hair up on the back of my neck when you said that with work addiction, the line of demarcation isn't as clear. And I think you were referring to when you know you're going off the rails, and you said that the line isn't as clear with work addiction.
No, because, I was good at my job.
Right.
I wasn't great at being a father. I wasn't great at being a husband. I wasn't great at being someone who balanced a household budget. But boy, could I write a magazine story. Mm. And could I design a nice magazine page? And could I charm people and put together a film festival? So when I was working, I felt like I was in control. I worked for myself for 15 years because it allowed me to create my reality. And my reality is better than the real thing, so why not be there as much as possible? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I noticed in those last several months, comes on a Saturday when I had nothing to do, I didn't sit at home. I went and just sat at the office. Even if I was doing nothing either place, I'd go sit at the office because I felt I had the illusion of control there. And that's what I mean by the addiction. I think a lot of the things that I looked for with pornography and with alcohol, I got out of my work as well. And these days, you know, I now try not to work more than 30 hours a week. I try to keep things under control and not get too obsessed with projects. And, you know, the old me would have put this book out in 2 months. you know, it took me over a year to get it out. And that was intentional pacing.
Oh, wow. Lesson learned there, I guess, yeah. For me. That sent a bit of a shudder because we tend to put in long hours and days here at the office. And thank you for that sage advice. That one stopped me in my tracks, I have to confess. So I appreciate the advice.
Well, happy I can open up a wound for you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Slice it right open. Now, you also talked about, you know, you were just saying a moment ago that, you know, if you had a long day and, you know, you were a little tired, you may go right to the computer for, you know, to feed the porn addiction. If you were, you know, wired, if you were revved up, lots of energy and stuff, you may go to alcohol. One of the other things that you mentioned that kind of fueled some of this was your need for attention and your need for acceptance. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think this came out of the situation I was in when I was a child, being taken care of by a woman who, in retrospect, and not an excuse, but in retrospect, was very mentally ill. And she had a lot of OCDs and a lot of little compulsive disorders. And I think what I learned from her was that she was pretty nasty towards the 3 or 4 kids she babysat. And I learned that if I could become her favorite, then I got it the least. And, you know, when there was something to do out of the norm, and anything out of the norm there was good, kind of like it is in jail, I learned to become somebody's favorite. I learned to become friends with the key holder. That kind of was how I was my entire life, all the way up, was I learned how to work people, how to manipulate people, how to get into their good graces, how to be charming, how to get what I need using my personality and my, manipulative skill set, I guess you'd call it.
Mm. Very good. Well, you know, I think that there's some really important pieces to this, because it certainly sounds like, because you've mentioned it a couple of times now, that I think is really important to articulate for listeners, is that a lot of the experiences and a lot of the characteristics and traits and things in life that happened that maybe culminated in some of these addictive behaviors for you began in childhood. Yes. You mentioned earlier about genes. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's one of those things. I hesitate to talk too much because I don't know the true science, but we talk about addiction being a hereditary thing. 3 of my 4 grandparents were alcoholics. It came out, you know, down the road that there was probably some sex addiction on my father's side of the family that, you know, in the 1920s and 30s, nobody ever talked about, nobody ever assigned anything to it. And I know that, with alcoholism especially, a lot of times you get those skip generations. And I can look at myself and my cousins and my uncles and my aunts and my dad, my mom, they're pretty much teetotalers, to the point where it's almost over the top how they didn't touch alcohol. And I think that may have played a role too. But I really think that I think that it comes down to the fact that we're all hardwired a certain way. And if you have a predisposition to this, as my father warned me I would, with the alcohol specifically, that I needed to, I should have paid more attention to what was going on, because it was in my bloodline. You know, people have heart disease and pass it on down. People have diabetes and pass it on down, you know. I know addictions seem more like concepts than actual physical ailments, but they are physical ailments, and they can be passed along just as easily as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we see that a lot of people, and especially when there's sort of a comorbid or co-occurring mental health condition. Again, we were talking about bipolar earlier. You know, we know that there's a pretty significant relationship between any type of addiction, really, and mood-related disorders and anxiety and some of those kinds of things.
Yeah, it was funny. In both of my rehab stints, whenever anybody would come in and introduce themselves, they'd talk about, you know, whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex or an eating disorder. They'd tell what their major disorder was. And then it was like they had a giant revelation in, oh, by the way, I have PTSD and bipolar disorder. And everybody else says, join the club. You know, join, right. We all have it. You know, maybe you don't see people out in the real world with it or wear it on their sleeve, but here we've all got a basket full of problems, and it absolutely is occurring at the same time, and I think played a huge role in that stew that I was talking about earlier. That I can't control what was handed to me by my parents or my grandparents. But it was my responsibility to know what role that could play in my life and to be aware of it.
All right. Sure. Yeah, that was one of the questions I had in the book and in the interview here. You're talking about having bipolar disorder. And one of the questions I had while I was reading was that an official diagnosis? Obviously it was. Do you believe you had bipolar disorder?
It took me a lot longer to understand it and agree with it than it did for them to give it to me, the diagnosis. I mean, when I was 20 or 21, I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And then around 23, 24, it was depression. And it was actually, I started going in and out of some therapy at that point. It was actually my general practitioner who knew me from when I was younger and knew me based on some of the things I was starting to do in public. And he said, you know, you've got this manic side that I don't know if a lot of people have recognized. And I didn't recognize it because I thought my manic side, I only needed 4 hours of sleep most of my life. I thought that was normal. I only noticed something was wrong when I was depressed. And when he gave me a pamphlet just listing all the different symptoms, I mean, and just things like, you know, going into debt, you know, stupidly, doing things crazy, impulsive. It's like, yeah, we all do that. It's like, yeah, but we all don't decide half an hour before we want to go to Europe that we're going to go to Europe and just drive to the airport. And on the way to the airport, see a massive car accident and drive through the middle of it so you can get to the airport in time. And that's sort of those things where it's like when you're an island and you hear these things, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I've heard of people who are, you know, sitting in trees and think they're God and they're going to fly. And I never had any of that. So I always had the stereotype of the worst case scenario that I'd ever heard of in my head. When the fact was that, you know, thankfully I wasn't that worst case scenario, but I did have enough of the symptoms that I finally came around to accepting it. Much like when I went into rehab for alcoholism, I did that to just, you know, make the judge happy and help build a case for myself that I was going to be cured. And I thought, you know, I'll go in there 4 weeks. I'll fake it. I've got a drinking problem. Let's lick this thing. And it took me about 8 or 9 days before I was like, oh, wow, they're actually really talking about me here. This isn't just something from TV, or this isn't just, you know, somebody, a wino in the street with a bottle with two X's on it, like you see in Bugs Bunny cartoons. You know, holy crap, I've been an alcoholic all this time and not realize it. And those 28 days turn into 70 days. Mm-hmm. Because, gee, I have a pretty big problem that I'm only finally accepting.
So in addition to bipolar disorder, you had all these other, you had many other symptoms. You had anxiety, you had some OCD. Was it just that the bipolar was primary, the most important?
I think that took center stage, especially the mania part. It wasn't right. That they needed to really take care of my depression. It's that my mania at 24, 25 years old was leading me to make some crazy choices. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, I guess you could say it was sort of like the episode with the pornography at 15%. And we were able to stop it, nip it in the bud. But I was starting to do some, you know, crazy things, quote unquote, and, you know, starting to make unhealthy choices. And that's what kind of pulled my doctor in to say, you know, I know you well enough and something's going on here. So and as I'm wont to do, when he gave me that diagnosis, I then just researched the heck out of it and read enough to really come to understand that while there's no blood test for bipolar disorder or a lot of these disorders, the symptoms fit the behavior. So, you know, he's the one who has the letters after his name. So I'll tend to agree with him on that one. And the drugs worked. I mean, that was the other thing. Once I got on the medicine and I saw what a marked difference it made, it was like, okay, maybe I did have something here because I think this is the way the rest of you feel. And I made the joke to a psychiatrist once. I said, I don't know why you're giving me pills to bring me down to everybody's level. You should be giving people pills to come up to my level, because when you have 20 hours of nonstop energy, it's amazing what you can get done. But you also, in the hours 18, 19, and 20, start making some weird choices that can have repercussions.
That's true.
See, there you go, ripping that wound open again, Josh. You just ripped it open again.
But no, but that brings me to my question. I was going to ask you if you are you still involved in treatment? You talk in the book about being a part of various 12-step programs throughout the years and things. Are you still maintaining much of that?
I don't go to 12-step groups as much as I did in the past. Unfortunately, there's just not much in Maine. Look at something like Sex Addicts Anonymous. Now, in the town that I'm in, Lewiston, Auburn, where I am, there are probably a dozen Alcoholics Anonymous meetings any day of the week that I could go to. In the entire state of Maine, there are 5 Sex Addicts Anonymous meetings in a week. Five a week in the entire state of Maine. Only one of them takes place in my town. I would have to drive 50 miles to some of them and 100 miles to another one. So when I was in treatment, whether it was for alcohol in Palm Springs or in the Dallas area for sex addiction, the resources in a larger city are so much better for people when it comes to that. And, you know, I hate to say this, but I actually found the groups more stimulating and there were more options and you could, you know, visit different groups and see people's different mindsets. And I just didn't really click here in Maine with a lot of the 12-step groups that I attended for a while. But I still have a one-on-one counselor that I see either an hour a week or 2 hours every other week, depending on how things line up. And then I do participate in a group for men who have sex addiction, porn addictions. Most of us have some kind of issue with the law. And then I do things like this. I write about it all the time. I maintain my blog and my website where people can, you know, get more information, buy the book. I keep this at the front of my mind because I have to. And it's not just the porn. I keep the alcohol at the front of my mind too. You know, I have to do that because you do have to fight this every day. It's not something where a therapist is going to give me a magic bullet statement that just lifts everything up. And now I can drink and look at porn like a normal person. And, you know, that doesn't happen for me. And that's not going to happen for me. I can't believe I'm 4 years sober. Technically, I am at the end of my probation very soon, so I could actually drink again legally, but that's a bad idea. You know, I think I could probably manage it for a year, maybe 2 years, and I could manage it just long enough to lull myself into a sense of being in control, because that was what my life was about all before, was faking that I was in control. And now I just have to recognize I'm not completely in control, and I have to be diligent when it comes to maintaining the recovery with my addictions and my mental health.
Well, Josh, that leads to another question I had, because you mentioned some statistics in your book that we know about 40-some percent are struggling. What would you... Do you have any idea how many men, I think we should mainly talk about men, as therapists, I would be interested in knowing what percentage of men probably are struggling with a porn addiction?
Well, I'll tell you what the scariest statistic I've read in a long time is. This is from the Barna Group, and they are one of the best statistics organizations on earth. They found that 33% of men between the ages of 18 and 30 think that they're either addicted or believe they may be addicted to pornography. Mm-hmm. That's one in three men under 30 who are self-reporting they have an issue with pornography. That's the internet right there, folks, because the numbers drop off as you get older. But in the, you know, in the 30 to 45 year old group, it's higher than the 45 to 60 year old group. This is a problem that keeps going up and up. Overall, nationwide, 18% of men believe that they may have an addiction to pornography. That's 21 million men in the country. 80% of men between the ages of 18 and 49 view pornography on at least a monthly basis. And this is them reporting it. Who knows what they, you know, weren't reporting. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics a couple years back came up with a number of 28% of people view pornography at work. Hmm. Now, there's no reason to view pornography at work. That's something that even I didn't do. I drank at work, but I didn't look at pornography. The fact that one in four people are taking that risk, now whether they're an addict or not, but the fact that one in four people feel the need that in that moment they need to look at pornography, that's scary. And that was really, you know, part of the driver of me writing my book, was seeing these statistics and then meeting all of the people through my rehab and in my stint in jail, and realizing that, oh my God, we have a huge problem here. And because this involves sex, because it involves nudity, because it involves naked people and stuff that's squeamish and we don't like to talk about, we're just letting this go by. And it's a lot like, you know, I think a fair comparison is the opioid epidemic that we have right now. People are now not attaching stereotypes to people who are opioid addicts. But you go back 30 years and they were the dirty people. They were the needle sharers. They were the scum of the earth. Well, that's not really the way it was. You can go back and look at Dragnet from the 1960s. They're talking about heroin. You can go back and listen to rappers in the 1980s and they're talking about abusing Vicodin. It's not like we didn't see the opioid crisis coming. We just chose not to do anything about it because we thought the people who were suffering were not worth our time, when it turns out anybody can be an opioid addict. And in writing my book, I tried to drive home the point that, yeah, on the outside, nobody would have guessed I was a porn addict, but I was quite a severe porn addict, a severe alcoholic. I hid it well. And, you know, you see these people on the news who get busted for sex addiction or different crimes, and you think, oh, they look like a certain way, and, you know, they have problems. And porn addicts are not, you know, 19-year-old guys in their mom's basement who've never kissed a girl in real life. You know, I met lawyers and doctors and teachers, men, women, rich, old, white, black, fat, you know, thin, and every type of person can be a porn addict. And the way that our society is reacting now to the opioid crisis, we can't do this with pornography 30, 40 years down the road. We need to be proactive, not reactive, because I can't imagine what this world is going to look like when, you know, nearly half of the men have an addiction to pornography.
Yeah. Well, Josh, from a clinical perspective, if we have a patient who looks, and we get the impression that maybe there's some addiction lurking here, I guess you're saying we should also consider porn addiction. I mean, at least investigate ask the question.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a porn addiction, eating disorder, gambling addiction. Do they have something going on that is preoccupying their life and that is acting as a soothing mechanism and a coping mechanism for a bigger problem? Because my problem was not porn addiction. My problem was not alcoholism. Those were symptoms of my real problems. And I had to deal with those real problems before I was ever going to deal with the addiction. I talk to people online all the time through my website, and they're like, I got to kick this pornography addiction. And it's like, well, that's great. Why? Why do you use? Oh, I don't know. I just think I do. No. You know, 94% of us have had some kind of trauma when it comes to porn addiction. If you look at the statistics, maybe you're that rare snowflake who didn't, but I'm guessing something happened in your background and you have to figure out what it is. And it's probably multi-layered, because I'll tell you, it took a lot of time for me to, and I still from time to time have those aha moments where you just connect certain things that happened in your life, certain ways you acted, see the parallels, and oh my, this is the way things actually are, and they are separate from the way I thought things actually were. And again, that's like, that's it. When I recognized what happened to me as a youngster, when I recognized I never developed proper coping mechanisms, and I could look at how I treated people and how I had a bit of the narcissist side and all these different things that played in together, you know, that's when I could finally say, okay, I can take on these addictions because I understand the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, a couple of times you mentioned porn addiction and sex addiction. Do you see them as the same thing, something different? And the reason that I ask is because, you know, we have people who have, celebrities who have been, who have claimed to have a sex addiction, and they'll go into rehabilitation, and, you know, they receive a lot of mixed press, because you have some who say, what is a sex addiction? What is that anyways? But I do notice, of course, that, you know, I mentioned the opening of the book before, you know, in that description, that very detailed, vivid description that you did offered of that experience in the chat room, there was no, it didn't come across, and I assume that it wasn't there intentionally. There's no mention of sex there for yourself at all. So do you see porn addiction and sex addiction as the same thing, or are they two different things?
I think we need to call it something other than sex addiction. I think maybe it's a sexually obsessive addiction. And underneath that can fall porn addiction and intercourse addiction and, you know, other things like, you know, exhibitionism and some of these other disorders that are of a sexual nature. I think that's really what it should be. There's a family of addictions that fall under this whole thing. But when you say sex addiction, people immediately start thinking, you know, you're talking about hooking up with somebody, you're talking about intercourse. Yeah. And that was never ever my issue. I mean, I've been married for now 15-16 years, faithful as the day is long. You know, that was never my issue. Might it have become down the road? Who knows? But it wasn't. I think that it really should be intercourse addiction, porn addiction, like I said, some of the other addictions, all under the umbrella of a sexually obsessive addiction.
Right.
Gotcha.
If I was writing the DSM, that's how I'd do it.
It makes sense. Yeah. Clinically, that makes sense. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like that you add the fact, because we have made this point many times in talking about different forms of addiction, that there almost always, if not always, is an underlying mental health concern, underlying trauma, some underlying force that is driving the addiction, whatever the addiction may be, and you know, to really receive adequate treatment, that root is what has to receive the focus.
Absolutely. And I know that, you know, a lot of people don't have the time that I was luckily afforded after I was arrested and before I ever got sentenced, that I could go into two long-term inpatient programs, that I had the time to read so many books about this and, you know, go to so much therapy. And I was very lucky that I had the resources that allowed me to, once, you know, insurance stopped paying, especially on the sex side of things, I had the resources that allowed me to continue to stay with rehab and stay in these intense environments, because a lot of people leave rehab early because the process is fairly simple. The first third of it, they're tearing you down. Right. And the middle third of it, they're figuring out what the issues really are. And the last third of it, they're building you back up, ready to send you out. And some people, that can be a 4-week process. Some people, you know, I met 7-8 month process. And that tearing down is really tough to take, but it's an important part of the overall process. Probably the most important part.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, before we wrap up and let you go and everything, if anyone's listening that thinks that they may have a mm-hmm. porn addiction, or thinks that their teenager or their spouse or loved one may have a porn addiction, what advice would you offer as far as getting some treatments or some response started?
Well, before I even do that, I'd make sure that I was capable of doing two things. I'd make sure that I was capable of not being judgmental and, you know, okay, whatever your proclivities are sexually, those are your proclivities. They're not everybody's. Don't judge other people, especially if it's someone close to you. If someone close to you tells you that they did something that you just find morally reprehensible or gross or whatever, do not judge. Because that's one of the biggest things that's stopping us right now is judgment. I think that's stopping kids from talking to their parents about it, spouses from talking to each other about it. There has to be no judgment. And the other part is it has to be safe. You have to feel like, you know, the world is not going to come down on you, that we're going to move forward and it's going to be better, because otherwise, why bring it up? So right. if you can create an environment for those two things to happen, I think that you can then talk about, well, is this at a critical point where we need to get you into some real help? Let's have you go talk to a therapist and just talk about what's going on. And if the person absolutely denies that they have an issue, you almost have to just, okay, and bring it up again soon after and keep looking for red flags. You know, unfortunately, if it's under 18, a child under 18, you can do certain things. But if this is your adult brother or your partner, you can't throw a net over them and drag them off to, you know, the hospital. This is a slow process. And because a lot of people truly believe they don't have a problem. Mm-hmm. And you introducing the concept of perhaps you have an issue, just saying that, perhaps you have an issue, and then step back. I know you want to fix this in one day, and we live in a right now society, but I'm now 4 years from starting recovery, and I'm doing darn good, but this was a long, long process. And truly, I can look back for years of my wife telling me I had drinking issues. And me just saying, of course not. You don't know the people I'm around. You don't know my life. You don't know it. She was right. And I can see that now. It's a conversation. It's a safe conversation. It's a non-judgmental conversation. And especially when it comes to kids, start working this in at the beginning. Kids want direction. Kids want to know the right thing to do. You tell your kids not to take drugs. You tell your kids to look both ways before crossing the street. It doesn't have to be a giant production. Just if you see pictures that make you uncomfortable of people who are naked or perhaps doing things to each other, just come and let me know where you saw them. And if they, you know, if they make you feel sad or scared, just come let me know. And if you see anybody who has drugs, come let me know. And if you see, you know, if somebody offers you alcohol, come let me know. And, you know, we want you to be safe and we want you to make good decisions. And then you move on with your day and your kid doesn't go, oh my God, you're talking about pornography. Because they're 6 years old. It's just part of the process. And if we can start making that part of the process, we don't have to worry about 50 years from now having every other man on earth be addicted to pornography, because we're not all addicted to drugs. You know, we're not all alcoholics. We took lessons. We learned lessons. Most of us look both ways before we cross the street. These are lessons that can be taught early on that don't need to be dramatic.
Right. Yeah. And you made it very clear earlier when you said, you know, your probation is about over and legally you could have a drink now. But you know that, you know, even though you're 4 years out, that slope is still very slippery, and it's best to avoid and to keep your focus in that, in this positive direction, than it is to even test those waters at all.
Absolutely. And I feel like at this point, helping people, and I don't know what it's like to be a member of, feeling called to a religion or anything, but I really feel right now that I'm supposed to be telling my story. And while I was riding on top of the world collecting trophies and plaques as, a city councilor or as a magazine publisher, I'm starting to think, you know, maybe I went through all of that to get to this point. And I don't need to go speak to 5,000 people at a high school graduation or a college graduation. If I can sit and speak to 5 people and really get through to them, that's more important right now. And I think that maybe all of that happened for this. And that helps me keep perspective. And, you know, the alcohol, the porn, that was part of that chapter. And warning people of it is now this chapter.
Yeah.
Keep telling the story, Josh.
Yeah, definitely.
I will. Yeah. And if people are interested, they can learn a lot of specific resources at my website. I've got a whole page full of them. And my book, you know, I don't want people to be confused that my book is self-help or that my book is dry and full of statistics, because I can rattle off statistics, but there were about 3 statistics in the book total.
Right.
It's meant to be a story that's a warning, especially for people who maybe are a little bit into porn addiction, that here is how far it can go. And here's on a day-to-day, blow-to-blow basis, you know, you also, if you like business books, I think it's just as much a business book as it is as a memoir of addiction. I just wanted to show people what happened on a day-to-day basis. And now 4 years later in my recovery, in doing this work day after day, on my website, recoveringpornaddict.com, I update it a couple times a week with new articles, really about recovery. You know, the book is all about addiction and descending into addiction. The website is much more about recovery. And, you know, there's a nice open forum for people to talk to each other there as well.
Well, great.
We'll be sending people to it.
Yeah, we'll put a link to it in the show notes. So
I appreciate that.
Yep.
Yeah, no problem. Well, we really appreciate your time. We really appreciate the work that you're doing. Again, the book is great. We will have a link to where people can go to get their copy. It's in hardback and ebook.
It's in paperback and ebook.
Paperback.
Yep. The process for making a hardcover book is just ridiculous and
expensive.
And that's exactly it. And this is one of those things where there is no other book like this out there. You know, we did a lot of research, and unfortunately that scares away a lot of people, because publishing is a business. You know, I was in it for years. There were a lot of great stories I didn't tell because I still had to keep lights on, pay the bills. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people passed on my book because they didn't know if there were dollar signs behind it. And while there aren't a ton of dollar signs behind it, it is doing okay. And I appreciate everybody who's purchased it, because, you know, if it can be shown that people are interested in books like these, other people who want to write books like this will be allowed to, and they'll be able to get published even easier, because we need as many people as possible telling their stories of porn addiction, and to not normalize porn addiction, but normalize the conversation around it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good point.
Well, thanks again. And we will certainly keep your contact information. So anything else that you have going on, you know, let us know. We'd be happy to talk about it and help you get the word out.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on. It's, you know, giving me this kind of time. It's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I wouldn't be able to come and talk to people. And I'm probably reaching 10 times the amount of people that I have with my book just on your show. So that's really why I wrote the book. So thank you for giving me a platform for being able to share my story.
It's our pleasure.
Absolutely.
Indeed. Okay.
All right. Well, that is it for today. Until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid. Thanks for sharing this episode of the Mental Breakdown and PsychReg podcast. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to follow us on Twitter and subscribe to our YouTube channel, where you will find all of our previous podcasts and much more. We would be honored if you would become a patron through patreon.com, where any donation you can manage will go to the development and creation of more content. Just visit patreon.com/themental breakdown for more information. Thanks again for listening. Have an awesome day, and we look forward to being back in your feed tomorrow morning.